Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Michelle Gelfand, author of Rule Makers, Rule Breakers, How Tight and Loose Cultures Wire Our World. I'm Bob Kustra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. The dividing line along human behavior and cultures is often blurry and little understood. Why are trains in Japan and Germany far less delayed than those in the United States and Brazil? Why are some company cultures, like Uber and United, prone to PR nightmares, while others seem more calibrated? Why is the celebration of an Olympic athlete correlated to whether they're from China, Australia, or the UK? In this encore edition of Reader's Corner, we talk with noted cultural psychologist Michelle Gelfand about her book, Rule Makers, Rule Breakers. Taking readers on a wild and enlightening journey through human cultures, Gelfand offers a fresh view of the world and ourselves. With a mix of empirical data and surprising on-the-ground discoveries, she shows that much of the diversity in the way we think and act derives from a key difference: how tightly or loosely we adhere to social norms. Michelle Gelfand is a distinguished university professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, College Park. Her pioneering research into cultural norms has been cited thousands of times in the press, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Harvard Business Review, and Science. The recipient of numerous awards, she is a past president of the International Association for Conflict Management. Michelle Gelfand, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's just start from the beginning, Michelle. Definitions, tight and loose cultures. What do you mean?
Sure. So I am a cross-cultural psychologist, and I've been studying human behavior around the world and in traditional societies. And I really wanted to try to understand, are there deeper cultural codes than just red versus blue or east versus west or rich versus poor that help us understand our differences around the world and within our own context, our own country? And I discovered over the years that there is a cultural code that helps to us to understand these differences better. And it reflects the degree to which cultures strictly adhere to social norms. And all groups have social norms or rules for behavior. In fact, we need social norms. We couldn't live without them. But what I found is that some groups have very strict social norms and punishments for deviating from them, what I call tight cultures. And other groups are much more permissive and lax, what I call loose cultures. And this distinction of tight and loose is really actually something that can help us understand nations and states and social class and organizations and even traditional societies. And it has a really similar pattern regardless of where you look at it.
And this idea of group norm behavior, I mean, the entire foundation of your work really settles on the fact that people do follow orders. People do submit to certain norms. And I think there was a guy in your book named Solomon Ash who did a 1956 psychology study that really shows why cultures work this way. Help us with that.
That's right. You know, it's so interesting and it's such a puzzle that culture and norms in particular are so omnipresent. They're so around us. They affect us all the time, but they're invisible. We rarely think about them. And so, for example, we follow norms constantly. We, for example, put on clothes when we go outside, most of us. We drive on the right or the left side of the street, depending on what country we live in, without even thinking about it. We don't face the back of elevators. We don't speak really loudly and start singing in libraries. We're following rules all the time without realizing it. And actually, sometimes following the rules goes against our better judgment. That's what Solomon Ash showed in his study. Just as a brief description, he had people come into the laboratory and view a simple sheet of paper that looked at lines where one line was on the left and three lines were on the right. And he simply asked his participants what line looks most similar to the one on the left that you see on the right. And it was really clear what the answer was across these different trials. And people first put their answer down privately, and then they came into groups with what they called confederates, not real subjects, who actually said the opposite of what a person saw with their very own eyes. And what Ash found was that about 3/4 of people complied with what other people thought, at least on one trial, which suggests that sometimes we actually override our own sense of rightness about the world based on what other people think and what norms are out there that we are subjected to.
So we're going to go through a list of examples in your book of how tightness and looseness works in cultures across the globe. But I want to touch on one aspect of your research. It appears as though from reading your book that this idea of a tight culture or a loose culture can, in fact, change over time. It's it's affected by other factors. And I think you use Russia and Egypt as an example. But I think it's a good example of how just because you identify somebody with a tight culture, a country, let's say, with a tight culture in 1975, doesn't mean it's going to be the same in 2015. And help That's us understand
right.
that.
That's right. And I think it's a really important point. Tight-loose is a couple of points. One is tight-loose is a continuum. It's not a dichotomy. So we can think about nations that veer tight, like Japan or Singapore or Austria or Germany in our data, and countries that veer loose in our data. This was a paper published in Science some years ago that included countries like the Netherlands and Brazil and Greece and New Zealand. And it's important to say that there's a continuum. And also within every country, there's tight and loose elements. For example, Japan tends to veer tight. It has strict rules, but there's some contexts where people really loosen up. And similarly, the US is relatively loose in our data, but there's some contexts where we're pretty tight. So it's important to think about how we can put countries and states and organizations on this continuum, but that we can zoom in and always find some variability. And like you said, it's really fascinating to think about how these cultures change. And we think we have some ideas of how that happens.
You mentioned the states. I was really fascinated by that chapter, having spent quite a bit of time in state government and politics. I noticed that the three states that were the loosest cultures, and in some ways this relates to creativity and innovation, were the three West Coast states, California, Oregon, and Washington. Help us understand that. And also, when it comes to Washington, Seattle, we all know, is one of the most creative cities in America. It has so many tech giants there, some of which, like Amazon, literally grew up there. But then there's the other end of the state, and again, I don't expect you to be too familiar with the other end of the state, but the other end of Washington is probably very different, and it probably goes to your point about how within your classification system, there's going to be some pretty significant differences.
That's right. That's right. And actually, I'm just going to broaden out and say that what we found both across nations, across states, and other contexts is that there's a trade-off that tight and loose offers to human groups, and that has to do with order versus openness. So tight cultures across the board and states have a lot of order. They have less crime and they're more self-controlled. The people are following rules more and they even have less debt and obesity. But they also tend to have less openness. So loose cultures corner the market on openness. They might be kind of disorganized and have less order, but they're more creative. They're more open to new ideas. They're more open to change. And we see that at different levels of analysis. So you're right, dead on, that those states that are the loosest in our data that also tend to have more diversity, which pushes groups toward looseness, tend to be more creative. I do want to mention also another factor that pushes groups to be tight or loose that I haven't mentioned has to do with threat. And what we found across a lot of different studies is that groups that have a lot of threat, whether it's from Mother Nature, have a lot of natural disasters like in the southern U.S. or Japan, or have a lot of potential conflict, a lot of potential invasions on their own territory, they tend to veer tight. And it makes a lot of sense because when you have a lot of threat, you need strong rules to coordinate to survive. And so those looser contexts tend to, not always, but tend to have less threat. And they require fewer rules to coordinate. And that means that culture has a certain logic that makes a lot of sense.
So in my intro, I used the example of the clocks and trains. I mean, that's so fascinating. And I think some of us who have traveled may have even experienced this once or twice. Elaborate on your point that they, in a sense, serve as benchmarks for tight and loose cultures.
Yeah, that's right. So I mentioned that tight cultures tend to, not always, but tend to have more order. And one way that I was, and also they tend to have more synchrony and uniformity. So, for example, in our studies, we could see that people around the world in tighter cultures tend to wear more similar clothes. They tend to drive more similar cars. And also their clocks on city streets tend to say the time more similarly. So, for example, if you're in Japan or Austria, the clocks on city streets tend to agree with each other. You pretty much know what time it is. When you're in looser cultures like in Brazil or Greece, you're not entirely sure what time it is because the clocks are very different, even in the same city. And we've shown that is one kind of public indicator of tight loose. When you start seeing clocks saying different times, you can sort of think I'm getting into a looser context.
And how about Sparta and Athens?
Yeah, in the book, I think it's really super important to think about how tight and loose don't just reflect differences in modern nations and states. And by the way, even in our own households that I can talk about as a parent, how we manage tight and loose, even in the context of our families. But tight loose really is something that has been defining human nature for millennia. And I, in the book, talk about the difference between, for example, Sparta, which had a very strict militarized culture where rules governed most areas of life, from what and how you ate to what you wore, your hairstyle, your career and marriage, even your exercise regime. And discipline was socialized from a very early age. And if you didn't abide by these rules, you were shunned or even banished. And actually, this might kind of sound austere, but it was a proud culture, Sparta, and they considered themselves superior. And in fact, they achieved great military success that was admired by many people, including Plato. And then you contrast that with ancient Greece at the time. That couldn't be more different. It had very permissive norms, frequent gorging and drinking, a bustling marketplace where there was great diversity of thought and cultural mixing, in part because it was the center of trade and got many ideas from the outside. And in more recent research, we've actually categorized traditional societies, over 80 societies on a tight loose continuum. And we can see that actually they follow a very similar pattern as we see in modern nations or modern states.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Michelle Gelfand, author of Rule Makers, Rule Breakers. And when it comes to the states, like the states within our union here, help us understand why red states and blue states is not exactly the best way to characterize our cultures. Help our listeners understand just how this works within our states.
Sure. You know, I think red versus blue is a very broad, unsatisfying way to think about the world. When you start thinking about the deeper cultural codes that drive our behavior, and not just that, why they exist, why they evolved, and what consequences they have, we can understand and empathize with each other a little bit more. And what we found is, and it published in the book and in the academic literature, is that we can actually place the 50 states on a continuum of tight and loose, with, in general, the South and some parts of the Midwest veering tight and the coast veering loose. And what we find is remarkable similarity in the sense that the tight states have more natural disasters, they have more pathogens and disease, they have more threat. They also were founded by people, for example, from honor cultures that had more rules even years ago. So this was also something that started many, many centuries ago, before even the modern age. And what's important to understand, too, is that they provide trade-offs. Like I mentioned, tight states have much more order. They're more polite in our data, and they have more self-control, less debt, less obesity, and less alcoholism. But they also tend to be less open. In our data, loose states, while they're more disorganized and more rude, they also have much more openness to different people. They're much more tolerant of immigrants. They're much more creative, and they have less discrimination. We looked at discrimination claims filed at the EEOC in Washington. There's a clear connection between tightness and discrimination. So the important thing is that states develop for good reasons to have the cultures they have, and they provide different trade-offs that I think often go unnoticed when we just look at red versus blue.
So can you use tightness-looseness theory to explain the election of Donald Trump in 2016?
Well, you know, it's interesting, and this gets to your point about change. I think the most important thing when we think about these election dynamics is they're not based on some mesmerizing personalities or some strange moment in history. It actually follows a pretty logical pattern, and that is that when people feel threatened, whether it's based on ISIS or immigration or Korea, they really want stronger rules and strong autocratic leaders. It's a deeply evolutionary principle. We know that's something that makes sense in a lot of ways. And so people in our data that voted for Trump actually, according to our surveys, felt a lot of threat, and they felt the U.S. was too loose. And also this was the case in France with the Le Pen election. We found the same pattern. And, you know, what you could see is that there are certain groups in the U.S. that are feeling tremendous amounts of threat and disruptions and want a more traditional social order. It's also the case, of course, that leaders around the world, not just now and also in history, have exaggerated threats and targeted groups that feel threatened in order to gain popularity. So it's a very complicated context where there are threats that are driving people to vote for traditional order and tightness and tight leaders. But we also have to be really mindful of real versus fake threat, because as we tighten, we lose that loose advantage of creativity and openness.
When it comes to understanding why a culture is loose or why a culture is tight, Can you help us with the Scots-Irish settlers and the role they might have played over the years in reaffirming this culture?
Yeah, that's a great question, because tightness is multiply determined. It's not one fact that determines it. One, as I mentioned, has to do with threat. The other has to do with people and the context they were coming from when they came to the U.S., what kind of cultural baggage they brought with them. And in this case, we know that people that come from cultures of honor, where your reputation is very important, often that arises in contexts where there's weak institutions and unpredictable resources. Honor cultures tend to have a lot of rules and a lot of strong punishments for deviance. And so that group navigating to the South actually was also a contributing factor in its tightness. Another factor was actually the Civil War. Many people, including Colin Woodard, the historian, would argue that the South felt invaded by the North. And in fact, in our research, the states that had the most slave-owning families are the tightest today because they had the most threat from the war. And so I think it's important to think about multiple factors that lead to tightness, including these bottom-up types of factors, including war, including disasters, and also even things like diversity. As I mentioned, you know, diversity pushes groups toward looseness, and places like New York and California from, you know, hundreds of years ago had way more diversity and had a lot of cultural mixing. And that makes it hard to agree upon any particular norm. And so they tend to become more loose. Mobility also feeds into looseness. When you're constantly coming and going, it's easier to tolerate a lot of different norms. So it's exciting to think about how to explain why these differences exist through multiple perspectives.
How does your research on tightness, looseness, cultures affect the issue of class?
So this is research done with Jesse Harrington, my former student. And, you know, we sort of thought about the fact that a lot of times social class is thought about in terms of bank accounts. But actually, there are the same deeper cultural codes that drive our differences, and they follow a similar logic. In our research, the working class tends to have a lot of threat, worried about falling to poverty, working in occupations that are quite dangerous, and living in neighborhoods that are also quite dangerous. And in those contexts, rules are really useful. In the middle and upper class, there's more of a safety net, and so we can afford to be more permissive. We showed this, for example, in one study where we asked people simply, tell us what you think about when you think about the word rules and following the rules. And we coded how people talked about these words, and it was very clear difference that the working class saw rules quite positively, and the upper and middle class saw rules more negatively. And so this is an important point to make, that these things also help us to understand social class, not just nations and states, but a lot of reality all around us.
So let's bring this down to the university level here at Boise State. You talk a little bit in your book about the fact that there is actually a marked difference in the college experience, and it may have something to do with where students come from and your tightless looseness theory.
Yeah, well, we were inspired by some work by Nicole Stevens at Northwestern that was looking at transitions that first-generation working-class kids were having at universities. And her focus was on how it's hard for these populations from very strong families, very embedded in groups, to be leaving the university to be working with total strangers. And it feels like almost a culture shock. And we also found something similar with tight loose. University settings are quite loose. They have very little structure. They're places where you're supposed to violate rules to some extent and challenge professors. And these are things that are cultural habits that are socialized among the middle class and the upper class, but not so much the working class. And in fact, these differences start very early. In one study we did with three-year-olds, we had three-year-olds come into the laboratory, and we couldn't exactly ask them what they thought about breaking the rules or following the rules, but we had used a very ingenious method by some developmental psychologists where they were interacting with a puppet. His name was Max. And they were playing with Max and having fun, and all of a sudden, Max violated the rules of the game they were playing. And we simply looked at how do these three-year-olds react, and it was very interesting. By age three, the working-class kids were much more disturbed by Max violating the rules as compared to the middle-class kids. So these differences arise very early, and we have to recognize that just like we would expect culture shock to happen when you go from the U.S. to Japan or from Germany to Egypt, we should expect culture shock from working-class kids going into dominant American institutions, and we should help navigate those transitions. And some universities are really starting to develop programs to do that, mentorship programs and other mechanisms to help with that kind of deep culture shock.
Yeah, I was just thinking that retention is a major issue in our universities, and this information you've provided can really be valuable when it comes to staffs learning how to deal with students in those settings.
Yeah, I think it's really important because we don't often, again, culture is so invisible. We don't often think about the fact that there are cultural codes that are driving people's behavior and that are affecting them wanting to stay in those new cultures. One of the things we found, as well as with other research in the field, is that a lot of times working class and first generation kids feel a sense of cultural homelessness. They feel that they're kind of separated from their original culture, but they don't quite fit into the new culture. And that can be a really lonely place to be. So I think it's really important to recognize, just like we would train people in different cultures and help people socialize when they're going abroad, we should think about how to manage these differences in our own country.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Michelle Gelfand, author of Rulemakers, Rulebreakers. In the book, Gelfand describes how much of the way we think and act derives from how tightly or loosely we adhere to social norms. Well, let's turn to the corporate culture. You spent some time talking about mergers and acquisitions. And I guess what I'd like you to also to comment on, given the fact that when we talk about corporate culture today, we're talking about multinational organizations. We're talking about organizations that, for example, bring CEOs from one country to another to run a corporation. And seems like it complicates tightness and looseness to an extent. First of all, explain the impact on corporate culture, sure. And then maybe we talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So the same distinction of tight loose can help us understand differences in organizations and for similar factors. So places like airlines or nuclear power plants or hospitals, which have a lot of need for coordination and have threat, tend to veer tight. Places like law firms and government organizations that have a lot of public accountability also tend to veer tight. And places like design and tech and startups veer looser with their mobility and diversity. And the most important thing about these organizations, of course, they can have tight and loose pockets within them, is that they attract different types of people, they have different practices, and they have different leaders who are driving the ships. And what happens when they actually try to merge, it can be pretty problematic. We studied this in over 4,000 cross-border mergers and acquisitions recently, a paper published in Harvard Business Review. And, you know, companies, when they're merging, often can see their great technical and strategic compatibilities, but they don't recognize that beneath the surface, there's a cultural iceberg that they might hit when it comes to the strength of norms. And we found that big differences in tightness and looseness in these mergers cost as much as $200 million in ROA. And it's really important to think about how you detect and diagnose cultural compatibility before you actually decide to get married. We talk in the book about the Daimler-Chrysler merger and how it was really a disaster that could have been prevented had we done some cultural diagnosis ahead of time to see where the tight and loose norms are going to collide. And that doesn't mean that it can't be a happy merger. It just means that we need to think about culture before we actually have these kinds of partnerships.
Well, I was thinking the same thing as I read your book about our trade relationships and how valuable your research would be to countries who are trying to negotiate with other countries, knowing more about where their leaders come from and the extent to which they can give and all of that. And I guess that leads me to a question still on this issue of the corporate culture. Do corporations understand this today? And how much of your work is applied to what they're doing in acquisitions and mergers, for example? Or is it safe to say that that's why you wrote the book and they still have a lot of reading to do?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's hard to say, but I do think that in general, because culture is so invisible, that it's one of the things that we don't tend to take into account in whether it's, like you said, diplomacy or in organizational mergers and acquisitions. In my field, we call this cultural intelligence, and you can measure cultural intelligence and you can develop cultural intelligence like a muscle. But we often focus on IQ or EQ, emotional intelligence. And when we're sending people abroad, for example, to negotiate, we often send people who are really technically competent, not necessarily people who are culturally intelligent. In one study, and it's on my website, michellegelfand.com, you could see that people who had cultural intelligence were people that did much better at the bargaining table, above and beyond their IQ or EQ. And I think it's really important, you know, as we enter this and continue to enter this globalized marketplace, that we start thinking about culture more seriously, both in, I think, for example, there should be a president's advisors on culture in the White House. I think there should be, every company should be thinking about culture and how to negotiate it. That's the exciting thing about it. There's ways that you can identify domains that you can give up some autonomy or give up some control, depending on your vantage point, for a successful merger. And by the way, that also applies to our own households. I mentioned about parenting. I've come to the conclusion that as parents, we're trying to negotiate tight and loose all the time with our kids. So let's be explicit about it. What domains do we need to be tight in? And what domains can we give a little more flexibility and latitude? And maybe, you know, agreeing upon this together, of course, some groups needing to lean tighter or looser, but still it's something that we can actually talk about. And I think my hope is that the terminology will help people to start having those conversations.
Well, I like that term, cultural intelligence. That's a good one for our students to hang on to as well. How has the internet, social media, our increasingly digital age, affected tightness and looseness across the globe?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, culture changes and our lives change in terms of the kind of norms that we're dealing with and the strength of norms. And in the book, I talk about how one of our key challenges is to figure out, where do we need to tighten norms? Where are they getting too loose? And where do we need to loosen norms when they're getting too tight? And the internet is a good example, a place that arguably has a lot of beneficial characteristics for us in terms of connectivity and efficiency. But I think it's become, and many people would agree, a very normless place where there's very few rules. I mean, when there's little monitoring of human behavior and little social presence like online, people do all sorts of weird things. Psychologists have been studying this for a long time. And I think it's that context where we want to live in a world that has some norms and that where there's behavior is regulated, just like we do in everyday face-to-face worlds. And that's something I think that we're starting to see on the internet, but it's taking longer and it's something we need to explicitly talk about.
You bring climate change into this conversation. Help us understand how that applies, especially in regard to a 2014 science fiction novel you mentioned, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future.
Well, it's really a good point. I mean, you know, in many ways, as Steven Pinker, my colleague, points out, you know, the threats that we have experiencing now as humans are far less extreme than they used to be in our history in terms of famine, in terms of violence. But like Pinker says, we also still need to be aware of incoming threats, and in particular climate change, because, you know, the idea is that threat tightens groups. We know that from our research on states, on nations. We know it in our computational models and neuroscience work we do, that when there's threat, there is a response to tighten up and have stricter norms. And that has a great benefit for order, but it has a really big problem for things like openness and ethnocentrism and creativity. And so in the book, I talk about how we can kind of broaden out with climate change and have scenarios more where we actually are broadening our identities and helping groups near us kind of deal with climate change, so that we are all trying to activate a global identity as we're trying to face these threats, to have the benefits of order and also openness. And I have some examples of that between Bangladesh and India, between Turkey and Greece, where these countries really came together to help each other during times of climate change rather than tightening up internally and all the other consequences that has.
Why is the understanding of tightness and looseness among cultures so important when it comes to the issue of overpopulation?
Well, this is another great question, because many of our societal issues that we're facing obviously involve human nature and human behavior. And where there's interactions among humans, there's norms that we have to manage. And one of the key issues with overpopulation has to do with norms for having large families that may have been important some years ago, but now needs to be negotiated. And this is taking place in many places. For example, CARE and UNICEF and other contexts are trying to help understand what are the norms that are supporting large families that's really problematic in terms of overpopulation. And I think once we start thinking about norms as something we can negotiate, we could solve our biggest problems like climate change, like overpopulation. Obviously, this is not a cakewalk. It's very difficult. But norms are a key part of our planet, and we need to harness them, whether that means tightening them when they need to be tightened or loosening them when they become outdated and are harming the planet.
Michelle, we've run out of time, but boy, I tell you, this has been a great opportunity to learn more about what's inside Rule Makers, Rule Breakers, How Tight and Loose Cultures Wire Our World. Michelle Gelfand, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our program. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.